Yeah, I've been told that we are really running tight. I think we have time for a few questions. What I'd like if the speakers could come up and we could have a few questions for them. And Marco has to leave, I guess. Thanks again, Marco. So we'll start here. Can you identify yourself again?
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's, of course, my starting point is prices where?
Domestic prices.
Okay, pick a country. The most interesting case in trying to answer this very difficult question might be India. When the government of India placed a ban on exports of rice, its purpose was to stabilize the price of rice within India, which is a very poor country. And you might think, oh, well, that penalized poor Indian rice farmers. And it did. But those most vulnerable to hunger in India are not those who own land or can rent land and farm the land and control their own harvest. It's instead seasonal landless laborers. And a high price of rice doesn't help them, it hurts them. So it may be that India's export ban, which was condemned by conventional economists as a disruption to the international rice market, it led to a price spike on the world market and much higher consumer prices for small countries in West Africa that import rice, and riots in those countries. It may be that on a total per capita, if you look at the numbers of people who were helped versus those hurt, the large numbers of landless poor in India who were protected from higher rice prices that might have pushed them into more destitution, maybe those numbers of people exceeded those numbers of urban consumers in West Africa who weren't hungry and weren't vulnerable to hunger. They were just inconvenienced by a squeeze on their disposable income by the higher price of rice they had to purchase in the urban marketplace. These are extremely complicated and difficult questions, and I can't begin to do justice to it. I think the generalization that I would draw, though, is that yes, urban consumers are politically powerful. They are able, quite often, to intimidate or to coerce national governments into taking interventions that will be beneficial to them. Whether they're harmful or helpful to others doesn't really matter. It's the urban constituency. These are the people who are politically powerful, whether it's the army, the police, the civil service, students, unions, all these people live in urban areas. They're politically organized. They present a threat to the government, whether it's a democracy or not. Keeping them happy is the number one task of most regimes, and that's usually where their attention is focused.
Can I add something?
Yeah, please.
To give you another side of it, but I'm answering from a political science point of view. We had similar problems in Ethiopia after we had in the Middle East problems. One of the things what the Ethiopian government did was to subsidize and to bring prices in sugar, oil, and some of the commodities. And this was partly because the poverty, the level of poverty, access to to the price of food is related to urban areas. You know, in the countryside, whether you have it or you don't have it, it is depending on the agriculture, other elements. But regarding to the price, it's heavily in the urban, and the urban is the only area where the stability of a country or a government is questioned. And that was the case in Ethiopia. For example, one of the reasons was Alamuddin, one of the investors in Ethiopia, has bought the sugar factories and exported sugar totally. And the Ethiopians didn't want to have the Mexican sugar. And this would have really led to a problem. And as a result, the government said, okay, there is not going to be any export of the Ethiopian sugar outside, and sugar, oil, and others were given in a mass. And this is the way the Ethiopians avoided from the Islam movement, because we are half Christian and half Islam. And we feed the urban, and with this we feed the political instability.
Well, thank you. So, two quick questions from that side, please.
If it's going to be quick, I'll have to scrap half my question. Robert, you were talking about how food prices perhaps hadn't really spiked as much as other commodity prices, particularly things like oil, etc. How much of the discourse should actually talk about the energy return on the energy investment in the agriculture industry? How much of a factor is this? How much can we actually try and limit this? And also, Sal, I'm just wondering, for your web-based or your mobile-based technology to actually enhance agricultural output, what kind of partnerships are there with, say, Vodafone, etc., to kind of get microfinancing of mobile technology out there, and is this a good way forward for you?
Before you leave the microphone, I missed a part of your question where you were running through some words pretty quickly there.
Oh, the energy return on the energy investments of agriculture, because it's very energy intensive these days. So when the price of oil shot up in 2008, in many respects, the food price spike followed that. Yeah. So I'm just wondering if this is something we need to really factor in much more when we're talking about agriculture and food price volatility.
Okay, I would say, in what part of the world are we talking about? If I look at agriculture in rural Africa, it's not reliant on fossil fuels. Farmers there typically apply no nitrogen fertilizer at all. They don't have any electrical power. They don't have any mechanical power. Transportation is carrying things on foot. They have a very small carbon footprint, but that doesn't make them wealthy or prosperous or well-fed. The interesting point, though, is what's happening to the energy intensity of agriculture in the advanced industrial world. And you sometimes hear that, oh, well, it's an energy-intensive sector. But the energy intensity of agricultural production in Europe and in North America has been declining significantly since the oil price spike of the 1970s, which taught farmers that to save money and protect their own profitability, they had to reduce their consumption of petroleum per bushel of production. So they adopted minimum tillage practices that allowed them to plant a crop without plowing. That saves diesel fuel. They adopted crops that can be protected from insects with fewer pesticide sprays. They found many ways to begin conserving energy, and the energy use in the agricultural sector in the OECD world has actually, over the last 20 years, increased at only 1/6 the rate of energy use in the broader economy. So agriculture has responded to the high energy prices in the 1970s with new techniques that are much more energy conserving. The tight link now between energy markets and food markets is being created by biofuels policies, by renewable fuel standards in the United States, by biofuel subsidies in Europe that create through public policy an artificial link between the agricultural sector and the energy sector, one that that I wish weren't there.
Okay, thank you. Mitchell, if you want to ask.
Well, the question was, if I understood, well, do we have, does the company has any relationship with Vodafone or other mobile applications? No, we don't have. Actually, it is farming and working in the field is more cumbersome than to deal in the top level of the pyramid of agreements. In the beginning, some 4 or 5 years ago, there was a company which came to say that they would like to have an application where you can use the telephone, the mobiles in the field. But fortunately or unfortunately, Ethiopian telecom system is heavily dominated 100% by the Ethiopian government. So there is no opportunity to discuss such kind of issues. But despite that, the system, actually the modern software systems, it goes very fast than anyone could imagine. It is applicable. You can use a barcode system with your, any kind of mobile today. So the technology is very advanced than the government institutional activities doing. So we don't even need the, those discussions are no more valid because today most of your mobiles, which most of the farmers have got access also. In the iPhones you have easily the barcode reader, and you can use the barcode reader for traceability of a farmer and the product and tracking their system. So it is not necessary as it used to be to negotiate with anyone because there's the plug-in systems in most of the mobiles.
Okay, thank you. So very short question and hopefully short responses as well.
Okay, my name is Paul Hagerman. I'm with the Canadian Food Grains Bank. Dr. Perlberg, you pointed out that most of the hungry people in the world are rural people, and they're not very politically powerful, and that their hunger is not really a political risk to their governments. Does that mean we can ignore them?
Well, we're not all representatives of governments here. The problem is, I mean, you put it very carefully. We obviously shouldn't ignore them, but in a practical way, all too often, we can get away with it if we choose to do so. That puts the question into very sharp moral focus for me. We can't allow some marketplace of forces on our behavior to steer us in the right direction. It won't happen. We have to, through our own moral clarity, recognize where the problem resides, and I think Prabhu Pingali had it right. It resides in the very low productivity of labor among smallholder farmers in rural sub-Saharan Africa and in the dry lands of South Asia. We have to, through an analytic effort and a sense of moral obligation, bring our attention to those communities. Otherwise, they won't be able to get our attention. We have to do it ourselves.
I'm sorry, I have to say something about it. We cannot ignore it. It's not possible. Because take the case, I'm sorry to contradict, but the case of most of African countries with the development of democratization or institutionalization of election, let's put it, it is impossible to ignore it. Because the farmers, they really, in today's acts, take Ethiopia, I mean, this is the country I know very well, Ethiopia, South Sudan. Who goes to vote? The highest voters are women. You can look to the statistics. And why would a woman go to vote? It's linked to the access to food and the price of the food. It is true, it's not going to be seen now in the coming, in this election or the next election, but it will have a huge impact. I give you one example to say this. The Ethiopian government changed it to the system of, you know, coffee to commodity market. The Ethiopian government have got today a problem of currency and a problem of Djibouti because the farmers, they had access to the price, to the world market price, and the access to the market in Addis Ababa, and they blocked it. They kept their coffee for 1 year, and no government was able to afford it. Now the government has really difficulty. So I believe in the past it was possible to ignore it. But with the system of democratization and institutionalization of election and having women being the highest who go to vote, I think it is no government in Africa, especially in the Horn of Africa, would afford just to ignore it in the cabinet. But the fact is the case for the time being is it being ignored.
Okay. So with that, I think I'll close the session. And I know people might have more questions for our speakers, but they are available afterwards. I think we have a coffee break or a very short coffee break and then 10 minutes coffee break. That's what I've been told. Okay, thank you very much, and thanks to the speakers again.